Over the past 6 months, we heard endless conversations about the white vote. White men made up 34% of the electorate this year, down from 46% in 1972. Things are drastically changing in this country. President Obama captured 80% of the growing non-white vote last week, just as he did in 2008. So who are these voters beyond the black vote or the Latino vote, and how will they redefine the future of politics in this country? What will it take to keep them engaged? And if you're part of this changing demographic, what will it take to keep you involved? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. The radical Muslim cleric Abu Qatada is to be released on bail after winning his appeal against deportation from Britain to Jordan, where he's accused of plotting bomb attacks. Abu Qatada will be freed on Tuesday with a 16-hour curfew. An immigration commission said it wasn't convinced by British government assurances that no evidence obtained by torture would be used against him in Jordan. Danny Shaw has more.
Court said there was still a real risk the statements of two men who were allegedly tortured would be used against Abu Qatada in Jordan, in spite of the Home Secretary's assurances that he would receive a fair trial. Theresa May said the court had applied the wrong legal test. She'll ask the Court of Appeal to consider the issue again. Abu Qatada's lawyers said the case emphasised the fundamental rules of law that Britain subscribed to, that torture evidence should not be used.
The Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, has announced it's recognising the newly formed Syrian opposition coalition as the legitimate representative of the Syrian people. Sebastian Usher reports.
The GCC contains the two driving forces behind the Syrian opposition in the Arab world, Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And it was in Qatar that the deal to try to end the splits in the Syrian opposition was reached after days of talks. So it's no surprise that Gulf states have been the first to confer the strongest legitimacy so far on the opposition. The aim is to build the international profile and reputation of the new coalition as quickly as possible, so that more financial, even military support can be given to it. But there's likely to be greater caution for now from Western powers, who will want to see that it can stay united and become an effective force.
The BBC's head of news, Helen Bowden, and her deputy have temporarily stepped down, pending the results of an inquiry into the dropping of a BBC programme into child abuse by a former BBC star. The move follows the resignation of the BBC Director General, George Entwistle, on Saturday. That came after a television report wrongly implicating a former British politician in child sex abuse. Members of the British Parliament have been debating the crisis, said the BBC. The British Culture Minister, Maria Miller, said the decision to pay George Entwistle a full year's salary was hard to justify. She said the only organisation that can restore trust in the BBC is the BBC itself. The deputy leader of the opposition Labour Party, Harriet Harman, said Mr Entwistle should only receive the payment to which he's entitled in his contract, and said the BBC needed protection in its time of trouble.
The BBC has made grave mistakes, and it must sort them out. But everyone, including us politicians, must keep cool heads and let that happen so the BBC can restore trust. That's what the public want, and that's what the country needs.
Harriet Harman, you're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. International airlines flying in and out of the European Union have been told they can stop paying a controversial environment tax on their emissions. Non-European airlines using airports within the 27-member bloc have been told to pay fines since January, linked to the amount of carbon dioxide they produce. Countries including China, Russia and the United States have spoken out against the tax, known as the Emissions Trading System, saying it would have cost airlines more than $20 billion over the next 8 years. Spanish banks have agreed to stop evicting people who can't pay their mortgages for the next 2 years. Tom Burridge reports from Madrid.
The announcement follows the death of a 53-year-old woman on Friday who jumped out of her fourth-floor flat as local officials arrived to evict her from her home. Another man in the city of Granada, whose house was also due to be repossessed, apparently committed suicide last month. Some of Spain's banks are set to receive €40 billion following a bailout from the Eurozone over the summer. And as the economic crisis worsens here, there is more pressure on the banks to stop repossessing so many homes.
Several hundred German clients of the Swiss bank UBS are being investigated after the authorities in the state of North Rhine-Westphalia obtained data pointed to possible cross-border tax evasion. 50 German tax inspectors have raided the homes of suspected tax cheats across Germany. Reports from Kenya say the number of police officers killed in an ambush by suspected cattle rustlers on Saturday has now reached at least 40. Local eyewitnesses and police sources said more bodies of officers were found on Monday in Samburu County, in the north of the country, where the ambush took place. Residents in the area say they fear more violence as the situation remains tense, with heavily armed security forces patrolling villages. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week's election has sparked a heated conversation about the changing demographics in this country. Over the past 6 months, we heard so much about the so-called white vote. White men made up 34% of the electorate this year, down from 46% in 1972. And that means that non-white male voters are on the rise, and they're voting overwhelmingly for Democrats. Exit polls showed that President Obama won the Hispanic vote by a margin of 71%. He got 93% of the black vote, 73% of the Asian vote, that's not getting that much attention, 68% of the single woman vote, and 60% of the youth vote. By 2020, millennials will make up 38% of the electorate. So who are these voters beyond what we're hearing now, black vote, Latino vote, young vote, and how will they redefine the U.S. electoral map and our politics in the future? What will it take to keep them engaged and active? Today we are joined by Pilar Marrero. She's a senior political writer for La Opinion and the author of Killing the American Dream, How Anti-Immigration Extremists Are Destroying the Nation. Hi, Pilar. Welcome to the show.
Hey, hello. How are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Felicia Sullivan, senior researcher at the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University. Hi, Felicia. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Rose, for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have both of you, and I'm wondering what you both think. Pilar, let's start off with you. What do you think about how this conversation is being framed? So many reporters and media are really using the sort of black vote, Latino vote. What do you think about those terms?
Well, I think they're real terms in the sense that the Latino vote, first of all, in the United States, the Latino vote is mostly Mexican. Okay, mm-hmm. So it comes primarily from one nationality, although not the whole thing, but most of it. And it has shown over time to have agreement on a number of issues. So in many ways, they vote in a block, and that's what they just did last week. The Latino vote voted in one block. And that includes, if you look at some of the exit polling of the Florida vote, which is the only Latino vote that has always been significantly different because it was back then when this conventional wisdom was created, it was mostly Cuban Americans who were Republican. Even that is changing. Mm. Cubans born in the United States voted massively for President Obama. So we're seeing a shift of the vote of Latin Americans living in the United States, citizens either born here or immigrated and naturalized citizens, they are shifting massively to one party. And that's what I think should be analyzed.
Right. And Felicia, what are your thoughts on that? What do you think should be the focus of this changing demographic?
Well, I mean, I think certainly so at Circle, we tend to look at young voters. And when we say young, it's sort of the 18 to 29-year-old age range. So some folks in that group, folks might not even consider young any longer. But we certainly are seeing more and more young people becoming engaged in the political process and therefore showing up at the polls. So this time around, about half of the young people who were eligible to vote showed up at the polls. And so I think this is part of what we've seen as a trend since 1996 of continued engagement of this sort of younger electorate, getting their voices out there. And in general, young people as a population are currently more liberal than the overall electorate. And they are also, given sort of population demographics, increasingly non-white and increasingly more diverse in sort of how they are as an electorate. So I think these are part of population trends, but I also think within sort of the 23 million young people who showed up on the polls last week, there's also a great amount of diversity within that group.
Right, and it's going to be so fascinating to watch as they get older, especially on the social issues, because they're much more liberal than seniors, for example. So half of eligible young people actually showed up.
Yes, there are about 46 million eligible young people, so that means they're over 18 and they are U.S. citizens. So 23 million of them came to the polls last year, and so that's pretty high. And they made up 19% of the electorate, which was a bit higher than in 2008.
We recently did a show about why voting in this country is so low. I will find the numbers in a little while, but in the 2008 election, we had something like 270 million people eligible, but only 90 million people actually voted. So it's great that 23 million young people showed up, but if 23 more million young people showed up, maybe you'd have the passage of, propositions that you were disappointed that didn't make it. Why do you think only half of the young vote actually shows up?
So, at Circle, some of our emphasis is also on young people who are maybe not engaged within sort of institutional settings. So I think when people think of young people, they tend to think of college students. But 40% of 18 to 29-year-olds have never been to college. So I think that's part of the issue, is I think some of the organizing efforts for campaigns do tend to focus on college campuses or places where young people tend to show up.
Right.
So I think there's some of those. And in an age when less and less people belong to unions and fewer young people are part of religious groups, I think some of these institutional settings where young people might have been in the past are not places where organizers will find them.
And what about turnout among the Latino community, Pilar? Have you done that number crunching yet?
Well, according to what the people who actually do the number crunching have said, Latinos were 10% of the U.S. electorate this year, and that's a very significant number because it has doubled over the past four presidential elections. But still, we have a gap. I mean, there's 23 million Latinos that could be eligible to vote or to register to become citizens, and actually only about 12 million vote.
Hmm.
So we still are slow to get to have full participation. But I gotta say that the interesting thing is that naturalized citizens usually vote at a higher proportion than native-born Latina citizens.
Hmm.
And I think the reason I speculate and other observers speculate is that once, you've gone through the difficulties of getting legal status in this country, which is really hard, and then, waiting the years you need to wait to get citizenship, when you get there, you're already engaged. You're already interested in what's happening and in taking advantage of your new rights. So they tend to be more engaged and vote more. And so we saw an increase in the Latino vote, but we also saw an increase in the proportion of the Latino vote. I'm sorry, going to President Obama, a Latino support Obama, at a higher rate than they did the first time. And I think the 23 or so percent that Mitt Romney got in the presidential election from Latinos is one of the lowest. I think the only other lowest was Bob Dole in 1996. I mean, this is a record low for Republicans, and it doesn't really bode well for their for the future,
right,
of the party.
You also mentioned the Cuban vote earlier, and in 2000, Al Gore got 25% of the Cuban vote, and Obama took 48% of the Cuban vote in Florida, up from 35% in 2008. What explains that? Because we've looked at a number of articles about the changing demographics, and so few of them actually quote actual people to ask them, what is it about this candidate or this party that, makes you vote for them? What issues do you really care about?
If you look, there's some very interesting exit polling that was done about the Florida results, and I think one story there is the change is the changing of the Latino vote in Florida, which used to be mostly Cuban, and now it's only 33% Cuban. Then you have the Puerto Ricans that live in the Orlando area, and then you have a whole bunch of countries from South America. You have the Colombians, you have the Venezuelans. And the Romney campaign was targeting mostly the Cubans and the Venezuelans and trying to get, you know, the images of Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro up there with Barack Obama, you know, comparing the two of them. It didn't work. It didn't work at all. Huh. You know, Venezuelans voted like 70%+ for Barack Obama. I mean, they didn't buy what they were selling. So I think they're voting mostly on what we know is that they're voting on the economy, but they're also voting on other social issues like health care. Many Latinos, majority of the Latino community that has been polled supported the healthcare reform. They like the idea of getting more people covered. And I think it had to do also with the overall issue of tone in the election and how the campaign, the presidential campaign at the top of the ticket, of the Republican ticket, actually did not address the diversity of the country.
Right. The Washington Post quoted a pollster, Fernand Amandi, in Miami. Yes. He said, "The number of Cuban Americans going for Obama were shocking to us, and we've been studying this section of electorate for more than 30 years. For Republicans, this must be very sobering, because in a quick, dramatic shift, your most reliable base of Hispanics in the GOP are suddenly not there."
Well, because part of the reason is that a lot of the Cuban vote is now born in the United States. Mm-hmm. They're descendants of it. So it's a different vote. People vote less about Cuba and more about what they're going through in this country.
Interesting. And, you know, just talking about that makes me think about the documentary Harvest of Empire. It's made from the recent book by Juan Gonzalez of Democracy Now!, and it really talks about why so many people from Cuba, Guatemala, Colombia came to the U.S. in the first place. And I just want to let you all know that it's screening tonight in San Francisco at the Brava Theater, a very good documentary about these issues. 7 o'clock and 9:30, 2781 24th Street in San Francisco. And then on Tuesday, tomorrow, at the Grand Lake Theater, 3200 Grand Avenue, 4:15, 7 o'clock, and 9:30. And it's a benefit for KPFA. You can find more information on our website. But really good documentary that looks at these issues. We're joined today by Pilar Marrero, senior political writer for La Opinion and author of Killing the American Dream, How Anti-Immigration Extremists Are Destroying the Nation. Felicia Sullivan is a senior researcher at the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University. And today we are talking about the changing demographic in the United States. What are your thoughts about the changing demographic and the changing vote? How do you think this will affect our politics in the future? And what will it take to ensure that these new voters stay engaged and also active? If you're one of these new voters, if you're part of this new demographic, what will it take to keep you engaged? And what issue do you care about most? And what are your thoughts about how these things are changing? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on our website or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Alex in San Francisco. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. The Republican operatives are now scratching their heads and suggesting what tricks they can use to lure the people that didn't vote for them. I think it's going to be very difficult for them unless they change their nature. They have a structural, natural problem. The so-called red states are basically people who want to exclude people by definition. The Republican Party would not exist if it wasn't for what it stands for, which is to exclude people, as many people as possible. Even legitimate elect voters, they're trying to make sure they don't vote. So it's going to be very, very, very difficult. It's like asking, you know, a lion to go vegetarian. I mean, it's by nature, he's got to hunt lamb and sheep and kill them to eat them. Republicans have to exclude minorities and all kinds of color or any of the minorities.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up because, Pilar, what we're now seeing is that top Republicans are suddenly backing immigration reform. What are your thoughts on this switch?
Well, we'll see about that. I mean, what we're seeing is two different conversations. We're seeing some people in the Republican Party, including some leadership and some of the Latinos that are in the party, which, by the way, have been internally talking to their own party for a long time and being completely unheard. I mean, they were completely ignored during the campaign. They're saying that, yeah, this issue needs to be looked at, the immigration. We'll see what happens when it actually comes to Congress, you know. And the other thing we're seeing is a backlash from the talking heads, you know, saying that, well, you know, these are people who just want a handout, and it's, of course, they had to back Santa Claus, and some really ugly, ugly rhetoric that is coming down. And so there's two different things happening here. So the one side of the party keeps insulting people, and the other side is trying to figure out how to attract people. Now, as to what the caller said, I think the only thing that really is innate to a political party is the will to win. And if they don't, I think they will. If they want to continue winning, they will have to shift some of those policy issues and they will have to stop some of the rhetoric. And I think there are many people inside the Republican Party and inside the conservative movement that know this. And I know there's even people that are gathering around the issue of immigration from the conservative side who are pushing from the inside for a change in this policy. So I wouldn't lose hope that Republicans will actually shift on some of these issues, mainly immigration, maybe some of the rhetoric. I don't know about the economic issues and other issues that are really a part of the party. But, you know, maybe the platform will soften up a little bit on issues of women. We'll see where they go from here.
Yeah, well, a lot of people say they really have no choice at this point. And yes. and Felicia, what about the youth vote and what issues are most important to them?
So, I mean, I think not unlike the issues that Pilar was talking about for the Latino electorate, that certainly the economy is very pressing for young people, especially issues surrounding unemployment and rising prices, according to the exit polls. But they, too, are also very concerned about health care and sort of the cost of health care. And in general, we're overwhelmingly supportive of either expanding or keeping the health care law the same. You know, they also were very much in favor of pathways to citizenship for immigrants who are here without documentation and in terms of raising taxes on the wealthy, as Californians voted for on in Proposition 30, and they are overwhelmingly in support of same-sex marriage, much more so than the general electorate. And I think this in some ways has to do with sort of the cultural environment that young people are finding themselves with. And I agree with Pilar. I think some of the problem with some of the rhetoric, especially on the conservative end, is I think they haven't actually tapped into the interests and needs of young people or really understanding them authentically. And I think they think, I think that some emphasis on sort of the idea that you can just put messages out there or market or just talk amongst yourselves will do the trick. And really, young people, they are on the internet more and they are interacting with each other more on social media, but they still are very heavily influenced by the people in their lives. When we did research in the summer, most young people are mostly influenced by their families, their parents, and sort of their friends in sort of face-to-face dialogue environments, as well as institutions that they trust and interact with on a regular basis. So I think any strategy that's going to reach them needs to really be there on the ground with them, in conversation with them, and really listening and responding to their needs. And I think that's part of what we're seeing in sort of their response to the overall election is sort of they felt overwhelmingly that the president met their needs and could handle issues more effectively than his challenger. And they have higher favorability of government, higher favorability of the ability of government to actually solve their problems. And so I think that they are clearly a voting bloc, just as Latinos are increasingly a voting bloc, just as increasingly gays, lesbians, bisexual and transgender people are more part of the conversation. I think these constituencies need to be listened to, and politicians need to shift. And I agree with Pilar. I think they will shift as they see that the political power of these groups is increasing.
And then the other question is, again, you've got 23 million out of 46 million eligible young people actually voted. We're talking 18 to 29. And the president got 60% of the youth vote. Felicia, what will it take to keep them not only engaged, but also active?
Well, I mean, I think it's also interesting to note that while the president did get 60% of the youth vote in 2012, he got 66% of their vote in 2008. And Romney got 36% of their vote, and John McCain had gotten 32%. So certainly some aspect of the Republicans' organizing efforts spoke to a certain portion of the youth electorate, because they switched some of their support. So I think keeping young people engaged is, I think, you know, what we've found at Circle. We just did some research on especially young people who are this sort of non-college-age population, is that people need to ask them to get involved, to volunteer, to contribute to campaign efforts, to contribute to issues in their community. I mean, young people just want to be asked to participate. And when asked in person by people they know, they generally respond. And many of them are already in their communities helping out, and they might not even think of themselves as engaged, but they're providing support to younger siblings, to community organizations, helping with cleanups. You know, like, I think they need to be asked, and then they also need information, especially the youngest voters, the sort of first-time voters, 18 to 21, really lack a lot of basic information about even registering to vote, where to go, how to vote, you know, where to find information about candidates. So I think there's some information that they need, and that communities need to provide them with.
And I'd like to go next to Vivian Poe. She's a reporter with New America Media, and she's been following the Asian American vote. Hi, Vivian. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
So what's interesting is you're hearing a lot about the Black vote, a lot about the Latino vote, but not so much about the Asian vote. Why do you think that is?
There are a lot of reasons. One of them is just because the population is still relatively small compared to Black and Latino in the country. And their voter registration is also the lowest compared to all communities of color. So people don't tend to think that that number matters. But actually, as we have seen from the recent report and research, that actually Asian American votes can be the largest swinging vote for this election, and probably will be increasingly important for later elections too, because they are moving towards voting more towards Democrats, and it's their population as new immigrants are also increasing, and possibly be I think there are already research saying that they are the biggest new immigrant groups in the United States.
And President Obama got 73% of the Asian vote. Do you know how many Asians are eligible and how many actually turned out this time around?
I don't have the exact numbers, but I think there must be a increase in that number. But I do not have the exact number with me now. Though I would say that in San Francisco, where we, New American Media headquarters, I think there is definitely a big increase in terms of voter registration for this election, as this is one of the biggest elections, and there are also a lot of local candidates and local initiatives that really pushes Chinese and also other Asian Americans to register to vote and participate in this time.
And we're going to take a quick break. And Vivian, if you can stay with us for just a couple more minutes, that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. Vivian Poe is a reporter with New America Media, talking about the Asian American vote. 73% went for President Obama. We're also joined by Pilar Marrero, senior political writer for La Opinion and author of Killing the American Dream, How Anti-Immigration Extremists Are Destroying the Nation. Felicia Sullivan is a senior researcher at the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University. And today we are talking about the changing demographics in this country. What are your thoughts on what we are seeing? And what will it take to get these new voters to stay engaged and active? And if you're one of them, what will it take to keep you engaged and active? It's your call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. And you can call today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. And that's where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. So just click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, are we really falling off a fiscal cliff? We will have a conversation about the ongoing battle over tax increases on the wealthy and $1.2 trillion in automatic spending cuts. This debate is about to rage. So what do you think about it? Who are the major players? And how do you think this should be dealt with? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the changing demographics in this country. Over the past couple of months, we heard so much about the white vote. Well, white men made up 46% of the vote in 1972. This election, they made up 34%. Non-white male voters are on the rise, and they're overwhelmingly voting for Democrats. 93% of black voters voted for President Obama, 73% of Asian voters, 71% of Hispanic voters, 68% of single women, and 60% of young people. So what are your thoughts on this? What questions do you have about the changing demographics? What do you think this means for the future of the political landscape in this country? If you're part of one of these groups or a new voter, what will it take to keep you active and engaged? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And you know, if you're a white man, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about all of this? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Pilar Marrero, senior political writer for La Opinion and author of the new book, Killing the American Dream, How Anti-Immigration Extremists Are Destroying the Nation. Felicia Sullivan is a senior researcher at the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University. And we're also joined by Vivian Poe, reporter with New America Media. And let's take a few phone calls. Let's hear from Aaron in San Francisco. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for having me on. I sort of had a comment or a request to direct toward Ms. Poe. You know, I think that one of the prevailing Republican narratives right now is that the various groups that tend to vote Democratic are the groups that rely on government assistance, or they're the groups that are not the high-income groups. And, you know, it's pretty incongruous to argue that while at the same time acknowledging that Asian Americans are voting so, you know, trendingly toward Democrats. So I was wondering if Ms. Poe could sort of address, you know.
We lost you. I got it, though. Vivian, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm just tuning back.
Okay, so yes, so Aaron wanted to know, you know, the Republicans often say that, and you hear this on right-wing media, for example, that the reason why so many of the non-white voters go for Democrats is because they rely on government assistance. Like Bill O'Reilly infamously said, if you want things, who are you going to vote for, Obama or Romney? But what's interesting, if you look at the Pew social trends, for example, Asian Americans are the highest income, best educated, and fastest growing racial group in the U.S. So how do you explain the fact that 73% of the Asian vote went for Obama?
I mean, I would speak on a personal note, and also just from my observation from the Asian media, I think, well, first of all, I think a lot of them are, as we spoke before, are turning to become more Democrats, especially for the younger kind of generation. They are turning to the Democratic Party. And so because of that, they would vote for Obama because of loyalty to the party. But I think in that sense, China bashing has become one of the most discussed topic during this election too. Both candidates during their presidential debate has shown that they want to be strong on China, and also the kind of the Asian uprising Asia countries and their role in the international platform would be increasingly powerful. So I think just from observing the responses from the Asian media on these kind of discussions, a lot of them actually don't particularly for cities like New York and San Francisco, the places with a large number of Asians, and they actually live their every life with Asian neighbors, they don't tend to be buy into that kind of strong language against Asian countries. They would like to see more more cooperation, more inter-country kind of relationships going on with the Asia countries. So I think in that sense, I think they actually tends to be feeling that Obama would be a better candidate who can build that relationship rather than Mitt Romney in this particular race. And just because of Obama has a kind of a record of bringing Asian faces to higher ranking office is also one of the points. We see Gary Locke, we have seen Stephen Chu on energy. So I think that also has some influences on the Asian vote.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Vivian.
No problem.
Thank you. That's Vivian Poe. She's a reporter with New America Media talking to us about the Asian vote. Again, 73% of the Asian vote went to President Obama. And we're also joined today by Pilar Marrero, senior political writer with La Opinion, and Felicia Sullivan with Circle at Tufts University. And we've got full lines if you would like to join the conversation today about the changing demographics in this country and what it means for the future of the political landscape. You can also leave a comment on our website or email feedback@yourcallradio.org, and we'll have a line open in just a couple of minutes. Let's go next to Monique in Daly City. Hi, Monique. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. I'll be brief, but 4 points. One, I thought the candidate, the Democratic candidate, was strong. I think that makes a difference. Two, I think a lot of the voters that are being described come from cultures, national origin, or roots, whether it's in Africa from slavery or whatever, who believe in the collective. And Hillary Clinton would not have got in trouble for saying it takes a village to raise a child. And I also think that there are more of the voters who voted for the Republicans who are likely to be like Joe the Plumber, and even though they would have fared better under Obama's tax plan, will say, one day I'm going to be in the 1%. And finally, my final point is that this logic model of if you feed the horses, they will excrete what the sparrows need, and the job creators, if you just mollycoddle them, everything will be fine. I think people rejected that approach. And I think overlooking the fact, you know, to quote Rosie Perez, their policies suck. I'm sorry, but I think people examined what was being offered and said, no, that makes no sense. They're record profits, and where are all the jobs?
Yeah.
You've got all the tax cuts. Where's the growth?
Yeah, well, thank you so much. And I also had to laugh when you mentioned Joe the Plumber, because I didn't even realize he was running until I saw a headline that said Joe the Plumber lost his race. But thank you for calling, Monique. Pilar, what are your thoughts about Monique's comments?
I'm sorry, I missed the comment.
Oh, she was basically saying that the fact is the Republicans did not have policies. This is not rocket science, right? Republicans did not have policies that reached out to the majority of these people.
Yeah. I think that some people are reacting by saying, well, you know, immigration reform will do it. And it's as if Latinos were just, I just read something that was really funny. They believe that Latinas are somehow Tea Partiers without papers. And if they give them papers, they'll just become Tea Partiers. It's not just immigration. If you look at the vast amount of polling that has been done on Latinas on several issues, the thing is, most Latinas tend to be working class, and they tend to vote accordingly. So they vote on, you know, health care. They vote on having good schools for education of their children and the advancement, you know, in this country. They vote for economic policies that help the middle class and the working class and the small businesses. And so it's not just about immigration. It's about it's about who they are and where they are in society and what they believe. And they don't have that. They do have a mistrust of government, that to a certain extent, because many of them come from countries in Latin America that are very corrupt. But they don't have this sense that the government is bad and government helping, you know, for example, improve education is something bad. Even though there are issues where Republicans could actually reach out to Latinos, and this has also come out in polls, for example, the issue of educational choice, many Latinos support the idea of vouchers, for example. Mm. But, you know, not that they want to see public education destroyed, but they would like to have some options because they see public education becoming so so bad at this point. So, I think there's a number of issues that Republicans need to look at if they want to remain in power.
And what about the history? If you look historically at the Latino vote, how have things changed over the past couple of decades?
I think more immigrant voters have come in. I mean, we've had large immigration since the 80s coming from Latin America, which is part of the reason of the fast demographic change in the last census or the last couple of census. A lot of new voters being engaged, you know, it happened here in California back in the 90s, you know, after the amnesty law was implemented in the mid-80s, there were several million new citizens who were available for voting, and when the mid-90s came and Pete Wilson started using Proposition 187 as a way of getting reelected, and if you may remember, that was the proposition that was going to take away education and any kind of health care from undocumented immigrants, they became interested and engaged into voting because they saw that proposition is a racial thing, as an attack on the Latino community as a whole. And so more people became engaged and started voting. And you know what happened to the Republican Party in California.
Right.
They became the minority party. And to a certain extent, this is what's happening in the national level. And so the Latino vote has become more diverse in its own way, too. I mean, it has become more immigrant. And slowly and little by little, it has been getting engaged. But I'm afraid that this engagement has more to do with the circumstance of just the reaction to all the rhetoric and the anti-immigrant stuff and the anti-Latino stuff, more than a real engagement. And I hope I'm wrong, but, you know, people wake up when they get beaten up. Mm.
Well, and now I would like to welcome Emily Rush to the show. Emily is State Director of CalPERG. That's a nonprofit that focuses on grassroots organizing, and they're now in nearly 30 states. They also have the Student PERG's New Voters Project. It's an effort to register young voters and get them to the polls. Hi, Emily. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So what strikes you about the youth vote this time around? What's different when you look at it historically?
Sure. I think it's so interesting because there were so many pollsters and pundits who were expecting and anticipating that young people who turned out in 2008 would not turn out in 2012. And that was not true both across the country and particularly in California. So to give you a sense here, across the country, national exit polling showed that 19% of the voting electorate was under the age of 30. And that was actually up 1% from 2008. And then in California, the number of young people who were turning out was even higher. Exit polling showed that 27% of the voting electorate was under the age of 30. So we had more young people turning out and a higher percentage of the total electorate being younger voters that were turning out. And I really attribute that to three reasons here in California. One is that we've made it easier for people to register or re-register through the new online voter registration system that the Secretary of State set up. And a lot of, I know that a lot of young people took advantage of online voter registration to make sure that they were actually registered in their current address. The second reason is that the many politicians, and Governor Jerry Brown in particular, were reaching out and talking to young people in particular. They were, you know, he was going and doing a tour of college campuses in the last 2 weeks before the election, you know, and encouraging students to vote on Proposition 30. And our all the studies have shown that when young people feel like they're being listened to, when they feel like their politicians are actually paying attention to them, they do turn out. If they don't turn out when politicians ignore them. And so I think that was really important. And then, of course, I can't ignore the fact that there were a number of organizations, ours included, that were making sure that student volunteers who were engaged were actually reaching out to their friends and that we had a get-out-the-vote operation. So we ourselves had over 80,000 get-out-the-vote contacts. And those were student-to-student, peer-to-peer contacts encouraging others to show up.
And then the important question is, how do you keep them engaged and active?
Yeah, I mean, we have an ongoing program on a bunch of college campuses where we encourage students to get civically engaged, get involved in issues that they care about, and teach them skills about how to organize. I think a lot of students will continue to stay focused on, particularly their college students, they'll stay focused on education and the need for, you know, affordable education. But there are a lot of issues that the students care about, the economy, healthcare, the environment. So there's a lot of opportunities.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Emily, and thanks for giving us those numbers about California.
Sure.
That's Emily Rush, State Director of CalPERG, a nonprofit that focuses on grassroots organizing, and they did a huge Get Out the Vote Among Young People effort this year. And we've got about 10 minutes left with Felicia Sullivan, Senior Researcher at the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University, and Pilar Marrero, Senior Political Writer for La Opinion and author of the new book, Killing the American Dream, How Anti-Immigration Extremists Are Destroying the Nation. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruthann and El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I came a little bit late into this. I wasn't expecting this to be the topic today. But I wanted to ask all of the guests, not necessarily demographic, but it appears that the keyword poor has disappeared from all discussion, and I'm wondering, you would cross gender, race, creed, age, everything lines, is what has been the story with prospectively poor people, working class people, and their proportion of the vote and the lack of the candidate addressing that as an issue?
Yeah, good question. Pilar, have you looked at this, the class component of Latino voters, for example?
No, I haven't seen any data on that.
Felicia, have you?
Yes, I mean, I can tell you that, one, overall, by the electorate, those making $50,000 or less, you know, 60% of them turned out for Obama, and they were about 41% of the electorate. And specifically for young people, given their sort of the current economic status and sort of the unemployment rate, you know, a good chunk of young people have incomes lower than $30,000 a year, and a good chunk of them are also raising children. So, you know, I think that idea that young people don't have families or don't have economic interests is not true, and I think they certainly saw in the Democratic Party's platform things that would more support their families and support them having more successful lives, and not sort of within that rhetoric, as your caller Monique said earlier, a rhetoric of being takers, but rather that government has a role to play in sort of supporting the economic interests, especially of those at the lower income levels or sort of trying to kind of pull themselves out
of sort of poverty level living conditions.
And it seems like, given the ongoing economic crisis and the high unemployment numbers, it seems like Ruthann brought up a great point. Why don't we spend more time talking about the poor vote or the working class vote?
Well, I mean, in general, I think that what ends up happening is I think we've replaced sort of the idea of working families or middle class in some ways, to actually mean folks who are at these lower income levels in many ways. I think, and that we've had some very vitriolic rhetoric at the national level that really vilifies poor people and people, you know, who do need a hand up or trying to get themselves out of poverty as sort of somehow, you know, slackers or ne'er-do-wells who don't have any drive or ambition. And I think that's just not, you know, the reality for many, many people. And so I think that's the other disconnect in the rhetoric that is kind of floating around the conservative, punditry, is this idea that, you know, you can make it by yourself and you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps and it's sort of the rugged individual. And I think really more that collective, which your earlier caller had mentioned, and is that idea that, no, there are some ways in which we as a society can support people in their growth and development. And I think young people, especially this millennial generation, understand that as sort of a valid role for government.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you look at issues like, for example, voters in three cities, Albuquerque, New Mexico, San Jose, California, Long Beach, California, they're giving low-wage workers a raise. And then you've got tax fairness across the board. A number of tax policies that would have increased taxes fell in many, many states. And so, Pilar, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think this might get more attention within the Latino communities?
I think the issue of class is very much present in the Latino vote. Obviously, you know, when we talk about the issue of immigration, the people who are voting are not the undocumented immigrants. The people who are voting are their family members, their neighbors, people who have been immigrants themselves and who understand what it's like. I mean, this whole discussion over quote-unquote illegals and how they come here to take away something from the American workers. It's a lot about class. It's used to incite, basically poor Americans to blame their own economic problems on the immigrants. And I think the way that we have seen the immigrant vote and the Latino vote and another immigrants in general react to this is saying, no, we don't believe this. And we do believe that immigrants are positive for this country, and we are part of it, and we don't take away. We actually contribute more. And I think so class and economic realities are very much present in the reality of the Latino vote and what we talk about daily in my newspaper.
Right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Ruthann. And let's go next. We have time for one more caller. Let's hear from Leslie in San Francisco. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Hey, I was calling in I wanted to ask more about why non-white males are choosing the Democratic Party, you know, what the depth of that choice is, and if it's just a smart vote in this instance, in this past election, or if, you know, if it's a longer-lasting trend. And I heard the one caller calling in earlier about it takes a village, and that was to the point of like, well, why is this new part of the electorate opting for the Democrats?
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Felicia. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of race, there's also some very strong gender components that kind of factor in here as well. When we're about ready to release some fact sheets that look at the race gender component of the youth electorate, and certainly, women of color, both black and Latino women, overwhelmingly supported the president. Yet we also found that African-American men were slightly less supportive of the president this time around. So it makes you wonder why that was and what was it about the African-American male electorate that showed up and that they didn't, you know, overwhelmingly put their support towards the president. And then, you know, we certainly are seeing this sort of increasing polarization between whites and blacks. That is, you know, we should be concerned about. We should be concerned that there's sort of this racial polarization happening since there was such a significant decrease
especially amongst white support for the president compared to 2008. So I think that's part of our sort of national dialogue, too. And so I think the electorate is probably a little more complex than we tend to think about in terms of not just along these sort of race lines or gender lines, but there are actually a range of really complex issues, both social and fiscal, that kind of play into why certain voters choose certain candidates over others or certain platforms over others.
And speaking of the candidates, I wanted to ask you both, and we were talking about the voters, but what about the politicians? The Chronicle had an article on Friday called Minority Candidates Make History. A win or lose, Democrat and Republican, California's House candidates on Tuesday marked a coming of age of America's largest immigration generation. We're talking about Mark Takano, a Riverside Democrat of Japanese heritage. His parents were interned during World War II, who will become the first openly gay person of color to serve in the House. Ami Bera, a first-generation Indian-American doctor who increased his lead over Dan Lundgren to almost 1%. Raul Ruiz, an emergency room doctor born to Mexican immigrant farm workers who ousted Republican Mary Bono Mack of Palm Springs. And then when you're talking about the U.S. House, there was another good piece in Business Week, and Donna Edwards of Maryland, a black Democrat, she said, "One thing that's always been very startling to me is to see that on the floor of the House of Representatives, when you look over on one side where the Democrats sit, and you look over at the other side, it's two different versions of America. You've got older white men on the Republican side and a wide array of colors on the Democratic side." And Pilar, I'm wondering what you think this means, where we have a more diverse set of Democrats, both at in California and at the national level.
Yeah, and we can just look at what's happened in California. You know, California went from the mid-90s to now, and now we have the largest caucus in the legislature is the Latino caucus. And it's very, very hard to pass certain bills that, for example, you know, on immigration, anti-immigration bills, or bills that, you know, cut funding for education, or things that are very popular in the Latino community. And so I think it just goes to show that as the electorate changes and elects people who look more like the diversity of the country, the effects of that will be felt. And I think it's interesting. I have been to every political convention of the last 25 years, and I don't see any significant change in the diversity of the Republican Party. I mean, when you look at the activists of the party and the people who actually go to the convention.
Well, you know, and it's interesting to say that because Kevin just posted on Facebook that Tea Party favorite Ted Cruz of Texas just said, if Texas turns blue, and a lot of people say it will in the next decade, right, no Republican will ever win the White House again, because you're talking about Florida, California, Ohio, and Texas. And those are huge electoral votes. And this is a Republican saying that no Republican will ever win the White House again.
Yeah, and they do have some prominent Latinas, you know, Ana Martinez from New Mexico, and Sandoval, Brian Sandoval, governor of Nevada.
Well, we're out of time, but Pilar, we'd love to have you come back and talk about your book. Pilar Marrero is author of the new book, Killing the American Dream, How Anti-Immigration Extremists Are Destroying the Nation, and Felicia Sullivan is with Circle at Tufts University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Are we really falling off a fiscal cliff? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the ongoing battle over tax increases on the rich and $1.2 trillion in automatic spending cuts. President Obama is calling for a grand bargain to avert the so-called fiscal cliff. So what's in store for the future of the Bush tax cuts and programs like Social Security and Medicare? Who are the major players in this debate? And how do you think it should be dealt with? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
On
the next Explorations in Music.
Truly, in Schubert there dwells a divine spark.
Robert Greenberg on why Schubert impressed everybody, including Beethoven. I'm David LaTulippe. Join me tonight at 9 for Explorations in Music.
Explorations in Music this evening at 9 p.m. right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. Of course, you can find us online at KALW.org. Coming up next at 11 o'clock, it is World Have Your Say from the BBC, followed at noon by The State We're In. Stay tuned.
Hello, this is World Have Your Say from the BBC. I'm Ben James. This is the place for you to discuss the stories you're interested in.
It is still a very big deal that Petraeus was involved in a situation where information could have been exploited. And that's simply too large of an error in judgment to continue on in the position.
Should David Petraeus have resigned as head of the CIA? The four-star general was told to resign after details emerged of an affair with his biographer. It's been the most read story on many news sites around the world. Give us your take at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. Also, we've been asking you online whether you wanted to talk about the BBC on this programme. We'll reflect what you've been saying after the weekend resignation of the Director General. You can tweet with the hashtag WHYS as you listen to the programme.